Welcome to Poets and Lunatics Podcast. I'm your host, James Pinello.
And my name is Jesse Lee Yarbrough, co-host.
And this episode is our anime episode. We've got a lot to talk about, and so let's jump right in. I think an anime that we both watched recently and had a great time is Full Metal Alchemist. I still haven't seen the end, though, so Jesse, don't ruin the end for me, whatever you do in this podcast.
I will be sure to not ruin the end for you, James.
So what did you like?
Do my best to not give away the part at the end where... No, just kidding.
Sorry, I swear, you will be hurting if you ruin the end of this. Okay. So what is what brought you to that Full Metal Alchemist spot?
You know, this guy, Luis, my roommate.
Resident know-it-all.
Yeah, resident know-it-all. We're going to have him on the show at some point. Resident know-it-all. Luis Sanchez is a great thinker, and you know, I'll tell you what. One of the things that really struck me about Luis when I was first talking to him about anime, we weren't even talking about anime initially. We were talking about Star Wars and his, how would you say, his complaints about the inconsistencies in some of the Star Wars mythos. What he would call the mythos is, you know, sort of the, and to describe it, how he would describe it, the world and how the world works in that particular, whoever's designing that world. You know, you think of Tolkien and his mythos, he has a certain way that magic works when he describes magic.
And he was very consistent with that.
He was very, very consistent with that. Right. So what Luis was describing to me is his complaints with some of the new Star Wars inconsistencies in the mythos.
So we're not, just to be sure, we're not complaining about episodes four, five, and six. Okay, good. No.
And it was like minute little details that he was talking about in the newest Star Wars, the
1, 2, 3, and 7.
Seven is the one when he was talking about specifically. Okay. Seven.
Yeah, there's a lot to complain about in 7.
New director, you know.
Still enjoyed it though.
Yeah, absolutely. Great movie. So anyway, but I didn't understand what he was talking about. And then I started watching some anime with him, and he showed me Full Metal Alchemist and the use of how the world works and all the little rules that the author of the manga was paying attention to when it was written is so consistent, and it was so great. So that's actually Luis, you know, he showed me this episode of Full Metal Alchemist. We watched the first one, and it jumps right into it. But that was the biggest thing about it, and that was one of the reasons I really like this particular series is how, and just so the audience knows, if you're not familiar with the show, the whole concept is sort of a kind of like a steampunky world where you don't see a lot of use of electricity or things like that, but you know, these state alchemists can create some things out of other things by the what they call the law of equivalent exchange. So somebody can create a metal object out of manipulating the elements of the earth, for example. You know, if there's a rock around, they could put their hands on it, have a transmutation circle drawn on it, and make something out of it. So really, really great series. Anyway, so yeah, that's a little bit of the premise, and that's one of the things that got me into it. And this has opened up a lot of other doors for me in terms of watching other anime, which, you know, as a 31-year-old, I've never been into anime before in my entire life, and now I'm finding that I'm reverting to seventh grade with some of these. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, anyway. You know, I it's funny. I never was much into anime, and I watched Full Metal Alchemist at your suggestion, and I was blown away. I really did not expect to enjoy it that much. Mm-hmm. My experience with anime before now was my little brother Joseph had a year in which he really got into Bleach, and okay. I have five siblings, and us and all the rest of the siblings were called that Joseph's weird year. Mm-hmm. Where he would go into the he would just go and weird. Watch his weird anime. And we never really understood why he was doing it. So maybe this is my weird year, but in any case, I'm embracing.
I think it's my weird year too.
I'm embracing it. It doesn't seem so weird anymore. It's great storytelling, and the art of it, just from down to the overblown expressions that the characters have at the drop of the hat, to the expressive detail that you see on every single frame. It's amazing. I was talking to an animator here that works with on The Simpsons, and she was telling me how with anime, they spend so much more time in relation to what we do with our Western cartoons or Western animated films on the detail of each frame. And they don't spend as much time with creating the in-between pictures to create that fluid motion.
Right.
So it's a much different focus. It's like they're much more on the macro.
Yeah.
Trying to get that great world established.
Right.
While Western animators are very much on the micro, trying to make sure everything looks kind of fluid as it's moving, and they create a lot more frames.
Yeah.
And I think that you can see that kind of philosophical shift in storytelling.
Oh,
where
they're
focusing on those larger, grander worlds in the anime, as opposed to in the West. I'm not really sure what we're focusing on, but it's it's a big difference, and it comes through in the writing.
Right. Yeah. I think I would agree with that. Yeah, just and you'd mentioned something about the storytelling and sort of filling in the visual gaps in terms of the in-between. I think of the Kabuki Theater, you know, and just the long-time standing tradition of Japanese storytelling in that, you know, and it is much, like you said, much more about the overarching, the macro, whereas here you have these performers, and don't get me wrong, it's an amazing feat to be able to manipulate sort of the puppetry in the way that they do. But yeah, the overall point of it is the macro, and you get a bigger sense of the story when that's the case, when you're not so overly concerned about the most minute of details. So I think that's pretty cool.
But what is it with those? Do you have any thoughts on what's the reason behind those overemphasized facial expressions that they have? Like, when I thought of anime before now, I've always thought of the girls jumping up and down, wearing the short mini skirts and their huge 30-foot eyes that are bugging out of their heads, and they're going,
I don't know. I'm actually not sure, but somebody had pointed out to me, I didn't realize this, but a lot of emoticons get their, you know, like some of the, there was an emoticon with like a, it's the face, but then the teardrop is like next to the face. And it isn't, I can't remember if it was a smiling face, like, you know, like a laughing so hard I'm crying sort of thing, or if it was an embarrassed or a crying thing. Anyway, he pointed out to me that like a lot of our emoji that we get on like our smartphones comes from anime, and I didn't even put that together. But yeah, I don't know why they exaggerate a lot of those sorts of things. That's a very good question. I mean, it's effective,
cultural,
obviously.
Cultural thing, maybe.
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah.
But it's effective. To me, I mean, it's when you have a very serious scene and then something totally off the cuff happens, this character who was looking serious a moment before now has a completely different facial expression. And I think it can just create some good irony when needed, and, you know, it's comic relief in certain situations, so.
I'd love to dive into maybe a couple of episodes that really struck you with Full Metal Alchemist, as long as it's not in the last season.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I can do that. Let's see. There's a couple episodes that, man, there's a few that, well, that one's toward the end. I got to think about this.
What about the one that really struck me was when the girl got transmuted into
are we allowed to, are we going to give a
sure,
spoiler alert? One of the episodes, a girl is turned into a dog. And it's interesting because we were talking about the exaggeration of the characters' faces, you know, and for comic relief at certain points. But this show has such a wide range of emotions. And I feel like sometimes they're like really kind of like more kiddish, like very, like, you know, they focus on like what would be appealing to a 10-year-old watching that cartoon. And other times it is not for kids at all. And that to me was the episode where the girl got turned into a dog is a very pretty disturbing episode, actually, in my opinion.
Rightfully so.
Because it's very, yeah. it just felt really raw and real and sad. There's a whole backstory to why she gets turned into a dog, but what the storytellers are going for is to make the audience members feel the weight of what is going on in this world. And it's pretty, the best way I can describe it is real. So anyway, I want to hear your thoughts on that, because I don't know if I've ever heard your complete thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's shocking. I mean, yeah, like you said, you're going through a story that is very fantastic, and it's based on a couple of teenagers that are maybe even younger than teenagers, probably mm-hmm. like 11 and 12. Mm-hmm. And, it's a lot of sunlight and roses sort of thing. Sure, mm-hmm. okay, their parents died, but it's very Dickinson sort
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And they, it feels like it could be a Christmas Carol or mm-hmm. something like that. And then you have an episode that feels a lot like a story about abortion or euthanasia.
Yeah.
You see a little girl, and you kind of fall in love with a little girl. She's all cute, and she's playing with the main characters, and mm-hmm. then they have, through the magic that's part of the story, the alchemy, they have this little girl being turned into an animal, and the characters react with the horror that you're that such an action would take in a real world.
Yeah.
And
definitely.
It's not completely untimely with the cloning and the other type of stuff that's happening right now. There's the type of bioethics that we're having to figure out. Like I remember I was talking with a philosopher friend of mine who said he was writing a story, he was writing a paper in response to some scientists who were wondering, well, what happens if we... So we know that the church says that if you were to take stem cell research using actual human stem cells and then try and cure cancer with the human stem cells of aborted embryos, mm-hmm. that would be wrong. The church condemns that. And so biochemists were wondering, well, what happens if we make it 7/8 ape and 1/8 human, and then we abort it, and then we use the stem cells from that to try and solve the cure for cancer or other things like that. That's just an example. Mm-hmm. And so he was spending hours and hours trying to research and mm-hmm. come up with, well, what's the correct response to mm-hmm. something like that? Mm-hmm. And when I heard that, I had the same kind of visceral reaction that I had when I saw in this little anime mm-hmm. of a girl being turned into a dog. Here we have, it's like we take something that's monstrous, which is killing, creating a life to kill it, to study it. Mm-hmm. And okay, well, that's wrong. So let's create a life, mix it with animals, yeah, yeah, yeah. and then we kill it to study it, and that's going to be better, right?
Yeah.
No, it kind of blew my mind. That's where we're at. That's mm-hmm. where we're having to talk about, and that's mm-hmm. that's a battleground, actually, mm-hmm. that we have to take a stand and say, no, this is there's something seriously wrong here.
Yeah.
And so I loved how this little story, which seemed like it was for kids, was taking a situation like that and then just showing the brutal reality of how terrible something like that would be. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was an excellent episode. It wasn't actually my favorite. I think there were some others that were far superior to it that we could possibly mention. But that hit me hard.
Yeah. And folks, as we had mentioned, our resident know-it-all Luis Sanchez, and being that we're talking about this particular topic, he actually just walked in, and I'm going to see if I can get him over here so we can interview him right now. Luis, how about it?
Okay.
We're talking about anime and the Full Metal Alchemist. Here, you can have my seat for a little bit. So, hey, how are you?
Doing well.
We were talking about the idea of mythos and having a story that has a set of rules and a world, and how effective that can be in storytelling. So I don't know if you have anything to say on that in specific.
Yeah, well, I think
any other
maybe anime. First to talk about it in the negative. I think one of the big problems of Hollywood nowadays is that they use cheap tricks to kind of deceive us and lie to us, and there's these plot holes that are just way too obvious at the end, and for me, they're very dissatisfying. Mm-hmm. So that's where the media of anime and manga much more, being anime does get washed down a little bit more since it's more for the masses. You could definitely see that the author starts and wants to communicate a certain mythos. The best way to see it in many ways is the source of powers, which, of course, these powers don't exist. And you wouldn't expect them to exist and make logical sense with the laws of nature in our world. But they attempt to create a world in which those laws make sense. Mm-hmm. I think that's what's beautiful. And more than anything, it allows you to create the medium that you want to communicate what you want to communicate. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's kind of my thoughts on that.
What do you mean that they use cheap tricks here in the United States? Or to, you know, the stories that we have here. Can you go in a little bit deeper?
Well, I want to be careful not to criticize certain movies because get an injury reaction from people. I personally do get frustrated with some of the Harry Potter movies, at least. I have been told that, and then the books, they're better. But it seems that whenever it's convenient, they just introduce something new to explain something. And I think that's the what we were talking about the other day, the Deus Ex Machina kind of thing we're talking about.
Yeah, it's a MacGuffin.
The MacGuffin. But it's like MacGuffin when it's convenient. Mm-hmm. Like
MacGuffin really only works if it's the same thing.
Can I ask, for those of us who are not movie guys, can you explain MacGuffin?
Sure. So
just for the listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Alfred Hitchcock was once asked about, I think it was his movie Notorious, in which the characters, Alfred Hitchcock, famous director, by the way, in case hopefully all of you that are talking, that are listening, know that. So one of his famous movies, Notorious, I think came out in the 40s, perhaps the 50s, was about a bunch of characters who are running around trying to get this very important uranium deposit, which if the Germans got it, they would win the war and everything would be lost for the Western world. And then if the Allies, the good guys, got it, the Americans got it, then they would win and, you know, everything good would happen. And afterwards, there were some audience that were asking Hitchcock, okay, what was it about this uranium that was so important? Because they never explained that in the movie. Why was that the solution? And Hitchcock was very upset. He was frustrated. He said, that's a MacGuffin. It doesn't matter. And so he coined this term, which is the MacGuffin, which means that if whatever the story is, there's this one really powerful thing that's this magic in a box that if you are able to get it or keep it or obtain it or keep it from the bad people, then you win. Mm-hmm. And if the bad people get it, then they lose. And then you lose. And so the whole plot can revolve around this thing that isn't really clearly defined, but it doesn't matter because what matters is how the importance of that thing is for the central story itself.
Yeah, which I think Full Metal Alchemist does in a very masterful way, because there's this existence of this portal and this little weird black dude behind the portal. And it's never really explained who it is.
And don't spoil it for me. I haven't seen it.
Yeah. No, but I mean, you see some of this character from the beginning. Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, and this is not a spoiler. You never really find out who that character is. You kind of get a basic idea what the door is. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. I think what Full Metal Alchemist does very well is that it explains the rules. And there's consistency. And actually, interesting, Full Metal Alchemist, and this is what it's beautiful, there's actually two sets of rules that go out through the story. I don't know how far you go. But do you know who the Eric's father's is already?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The only thing I haven't seen is the last season.
Okay.
So don't spoil the last season.
So what's great is that you find out that after the creation of the first Philosopher's Stone, which is father and the actual father of the Eric brothers, one of them walks west and one of them walks east. And they actually found alchemy and alkahestry in their respective countries.
That's cool.
And actually the homunculus shield And the shield of the Eric brothers represents the different type of alchemy. If you look at the homunculus shield, it's a dragon biting its own tail. If you look at the shield of the Eric brother, it's a dragon wrapped around what looks almost like a cross. And they explain that the, and also they explain at some point that the dragon, the two dragons, is a representation of alchemy and God, which is, again, this theme that kind of repeats itself throughout the whole story. But the alchemy that you use in Amistry, it's circular. It runs around the earth, which is why some of the alchemists try to figure out, wait, there's something weird going on. Mm-hmm. You kind of then later find out that the father, the bad guy, is channeling all the alchemy in the country and kind of controls it because that's what he taught them to do.
Mm.
That's why there's an episode where he could cancel Alchemistry throughout the whole country, because he made it so that any alchemy had to pass through him. Mm-hmm. But the people from Qin that study alchemy, they learn how to channel the earth to draw energy and to use their bodies to form it and do what it's alchemy, because they were taught the real alchemy. That's interesting. Alchemy is actually a lie. It's a manipulated form, art, or religion, let's say, where alchemy is the full truth.
Wow.
So that's constant symbolism throughout this series. And that's one of the things, the greatest thing about Full Metal Alchemist 2. Every time you watch it, you discover more things.
Mm-hmm.
But back to the original thought about the mythos. I think the MacGuffin also goes into a bigger part of telling history through novelization or just actual history, not just theology. I think there is a mystery part in MacGuffins, or however mm-hmm. you say it. There's something that you kind of have to accept that you might not fully understand. But that doesn't mean that there might be logical rules that could still be formulated throughout that universe.
Sure.
I think you see that in religion, at least in the Christian faith. There's certain themes that we do consider mysterious, which doesn't mean we can't...
logically defend them.
Exactly. Logically right. defend them or understand them. It's just we can't fully grasp the reality of all of them. Mm-hmm. But they still exist. And since they exist, they emanate some power, some nature from them, which makes logical rules throughout our own nature, which is what we call natural law in the Catholic faith. And we could not only understand our own nature, but we could make logical rules that help us understand better that mystery that is behind the veil, you could say.
So is a little, it seems like you could almost use some of these animes for formation purposes.
Well, there's two themes that I've seen in animes that have always attracted to me. And they've actually talked heavily about virtue, especially shows like Naruto and a little bit Bleach. But you see shows like Trigun, and
so good job, even Joseph.
I mean, in many ways, even Death Note. They do talk about values and the importance of certain values. And in Naruto, one of the big themes is friendship, which is, I think the word in Japanese is nakama, and the importance of friendship. But it's not just this, like, the power of friendship will unite us. It's no, it's because I have friends, and me and my friends, we share certain convictions. I'm willing to die or greatly suffer to defend that. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who've seen Naruto, it's the basic plot, not really spoiling anything, is that two kids that grow up as frenemies, really, but they have very important shared common goals, they get separated, and one of those kids decides, no matter what, I'm going to save him from the dark side.
Mm-hmm.
And he sacrifices a lot of things for that to happen. At the same time, people admire him for his strong conviction and his strong sense of friendship, and he gains allies. And you see a very transformable spirit that kind of emanates to other people.
You know, that reminds me a lot of, I think it was St. John of the Cross who said, a lot of the world has been saved through the mitigating power of friendship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think what a lot of times we forget as Christians is that evangelization and apostolate, the best form of it is really friendship. It's just you wanting the best for another person, which is the basic definition of friendship. And the best thing you could give that person is their faith. Maybe not verbally, but definitely through action and through shared convictions and growth. But regardless of whatever specific value different animes have, it's not just the mythos. It's the mythos to communicate something. And most of the time, it's a certain value that they want to communicate. Some of them, a certain type of virtue, be it courage or some sense of justice. Not much stuff like temperance, which is always a little bit harder to grasp. But definitely many times, certain notions of prudence. You definitely see stuff like that in Death Note, where people have to make very meticulous decisions and learn to know what to say and what not to say, what to predict, and if their prediction is wrong, what to try to predict next time. That show gets really good into those kind of things.
Gotta check that out.
But it really challenges the viewer to engage in these thoughts, which, I think a lot of the stuff that we get out of the United States doesn't tend to do that. Big production, just great visuals, and a plot that will allow you to see those things put together, which is what I think the last Star Wars movies was. A plot good enough to put together some really good special effects.
Don't forget the nostalgia. That was important too.
Yeah, but nah. Nostalgia lasted for me 30 minutes, I think. And then some weird shit happened that didn't make sense. And I was like, okay.
Oh, come on. It was the Millennium Falcon. That was great.
No, I really enjoyed watching it the first time. And I enjoyed it the second time. And it just kind of got progressively less as the times that I've watched it. But I think it was kind of geared for that, and I think a lot of the things that they set up could be very well redeemed by a second movie.
We'll have to see. I have little faith. We'll see. We'll see. I hope, and I know a lot of people would find this odd to hear, but I hope they bring George Lucas in a little bit more.
What?
They completely caught him off of the seventh movie, and if you look at how episode 4, 5, and 6 were made, that was a big mistake. And it's very interesting to me to read about it. But episode 4, he had pretty much big control over it. But he was kind of... there was a couple people that were helping him with the rewrites and all that. I think one of them was his wife. It was very instrumental for episode 4, A New Hope.
So that's why 1, 2, and 3 were not as good then, right?
Because in 1, 2, and 3, he had full control.
Yeah.
Nobody told him what to do. He was director, he was producer, executive producer. He was funding it himself, as far as I know, for Lucasfilm. He could do whatever he wants. So that explains why that was so bad. So we have episode 4, which is not a... I don't think it's a great movie. I think the reality of the fact that you're seeing so many amazing things for the first time in, what, 1969? That's the year that came out?
Mm-hmm. Or 79.
79?
Yeah.
Helped that movie do so well, because it really was an experience that nobody else saw before that. Mm-hmm. But there was a decent plot that held things together. But then you have episode 5. And as far as I know, the studio really realized, okay, this could be something great. But we're obviously seeing that you have some really weird ideas, George Lucas. So why don't you tell us the story, and we'll get you somebody else to direct the movie, and we'll get you somebody else to write the script, which is what happened. And I forget the name of the director and the guy that wrote the script, but they're instrumental. And then you have what I think is the best of all the Star Wars movies, which is The Empire Strikes Back.
Agreed. I mean, 5 is amazing. No doubt. Amazing.
And then you get episode 6, which Lucas gained more creative control. And he was now co-screenwriter of the movie, as far as I remember. Not just somebody else writing the screenplay, but he co-wrote it with the person that wrote The Fifth Grade.
Unless you have, I mean, the first 30 minutes of a trilogy having nothing to do with anything that the whole trilogy was about, which is basically the whole Jabba's Palace thing, which is not the best storytelling technique. But I thought that last hour really, really turned things around. I thought that was amazing.
It was good, again, but not as good as The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
And it could have wrapped things around much better. And of course, episode 5 and 6 does also bring out a lot of the plot holes from episode 4, which more than anything, because they made episode 4 as just a standalone movie. They didn't think of the implications of a larger series. I mean, Luke and Leia definitely have a sexual thing going on. They end up being brothers and sisters. I don't think that's something that, as a director, you kind of like, oh, yeah, let's make some like sexual tension here. Let's borderline incest, and then let's make something else going on.
Jettison that.
But episode 7, Lucas had no creative control. Not only did he have no creative control on the screenplay, he had no creative control over the story.
Yeah, well, he wrote a script. And
years ago.
yeah, Kennedy took the script and then threw it out.
Yeah. So I think, and he actually says it, and I think it's the criticism of a lot of people that are diehard fans have, is that they didn't do that much new things, mm-hmm. which is what he was attempting to do with episode 1, 2, and 3. And that's kind of the good things, I think, of episode 1, 2, and 3, is that there's nothing in those episodes that is exactly the same as the other movies. There are certain themes there are, but that's just, you know, storytelling of a bigger story and mythos. But there's no plots that are basically the same, where episode 7, there's just 4 or 5 plots that are just copy and paste from the other 6 movies. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's a little bit of an insult.
Yeah, I gotcha. You know, something that's interesting, how you say themes, overarching themes with storytelling and things like that. Have you ever heard the argument, or people have often said that Star Wars, the original, is very much from a Japanese a director called Kurosawa, who he copied a lot of things. Have you heard that?
I don't. The only thing I've heard is that the Darth Vader suit was modeled off of a samurai,
yeah, samurai
armor.
Yeah.
A specific one that George Lucas saw at the museum, I think, at the Met.
Which is awesome.
Yeah. I don't know much more than that.
Okay. Question. Should they... This is kind of incendiary, so should they remake the first episodes 1, 2, and 3?
Well, actually, Topher Grace,
what?
The actor from that 70s show, wrote or gave an indication of how you should edit episode 1, 2, and 3. So if you go to YouTube and you search for Star Wars Topher Grace, there's an edited, somebody took his instructions and made an edition of the 1, 2, and 3 into just a 2.5-hour movie, which is basically 10 minutes of episode 1, an hour episode 2, and an hour episode 3. Hmm. And no, what's that comic relief guy's name?
Jar Jar.
No Jar Jar Binks. At all. And it actually makes for a much more compelling movie.
Huh.
And things flow very well. There's not a lot of empty stuff, which there were with those movies. It just gets to the point, and yeah.
So there's no, like, they took all pretty much all the romance out of episode 2, this 45 minutes.
Yeah, they took almost all of that out. They keep a little bit, because part of that story is how Anakin breaking the rules and getting into territories that he wasn't supposed to, kind of led to, I guess, bigger sins. But they do take away all of the fluff. And again, no Jar Jar Binks, I think there is a compelling argument that Jar Jar Binks is a Sith, or was meant to be a Sith.
See, I've heard this argument.
But that's a whole other story. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure I believe that. I'm really not sure I believe that. Although it would be hilarious.
But I guess the other thing that frustrated me is episode 7. I've taken the time. I haven't read any of the books. But I have read the whole Clone Wars series. Not read, but seen the TV show.
Yes.
And seen some very of the anime. Other offshooted. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, very very well animated, and kind of the style of anime.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this great mythos that they're setting up.
In the Clone Wars series.
In the Clone Wars series. Like, that's where they really delved into the mythos of what a Jedi was. Yeah. Not just the current Jedis. They even go into ancient Jedis and what they were representing, because Jedis are actually the offshoot of another religion within the universe 2,000 years before that. Mm-hmm. And then those are the offshoot of another religion. It's very interesting. And not every point where Jedi is just considered the good guys in the galaxies to be completely on the light side. There's actually some of them that saw as important to thread in the middle, both dark and light. It's a lot to talk about. But
yeah.
Episode 7 had a chance to continue a lot of those things. It had a chance also to continue just some of the logical realities of ending a civil war.
Yeah.
In a big galaxy.
Yeah.
Because they don't address it at all. Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to have a Star Wars episode.
Yeah. Maybe.
We should have... Okay, so we started off talking about anime and we shifted to Star Wars. But hey, that works out.
Yeah.
Luis, thank you very much for coming on.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
We'll have you again.
Sure.
Awesome.
I'll be around.
All right.
So we are back just about out of time, Jesse Lee. Just enough time to sign off and say goodbye to the good folks.
All right. Well, we're coming to you from here. We're not in Santa Monica this week.
Yeah, we're on Sherman the road Oaks. Today. On the road.
Yeah, and just so everybody's aware, Casey Kawayu, our resident sound tech, is also not here, which is why we don't have a lot of cool things queued up and a lot of the bells and whistles.
Casey, we miss you. Have fun in Europe.
Don't
go too crazy.
Yeah. Say hello to the Pope for us. Get his autograph. Anyway, Jesse Lee Yarbrough signing off.
And I'm James Pinello. We'll see you next time on Poets and Lunatics.